And now, ladies and gentlemen, for another eyewitness account of the invasion, we take you to London. NBC in New York calling London.
Now, the first wasn't talked about very much, except from a purely technical point of view. It was something beyond our control. Something desperately important, but altogether too big for us. Something men only discussed in their prayers. But the second, we hoped, was very much under our control. In spite of the fact that the whole invasion force it had to be trained and embarked within only a few miles of enemy aerodromes, every precaution had been taken to ensure that he didn't find out. A little Yorkshireman, looking round as he stepped out of a lorry and marched down to his landing craft, summed it up in three words. What? No bands? Yes, that was it. Here were thousands and thousands of men going off on what might well prove the greatest battle in history. With no bands, no cheering crowds to wave them on their way. But on the contrary, slinking off and taking every possible precaution to get away unnoticed. From the point of view of enemy action, last night was one of the dullest pre-assault nights I've ever known, and I've known most of them. As far as our own force was concerned, there was no interference by enemy aircraft, U-boats or E-boats, and our only concern was the high, choppy sea which was playing havoc with some of the smaller craft. The sailors and marines who got those craft across worked miracles. By dawn, the sea still showed no signs of abating. And as the wind was from the northwest, it meant that the surf would be very, very dangerous and the shallow bay the same. As the assault craft grouped into position, there was a terrific bombardment by cruisers and destroyers, combined with an intensive bombing on the enemy coastal batteries. Almost immediately, the coastal batteries answered back. And although I didn't see any actual damage done, some of their shells fell unpleasantly close to us. Those batteries were soon put out of action. The other main problem was, of course, that of the minefields. Minesweepers, the spearhead of the invasion force, were sweeping ahead of us during the night and were now clearing the approaches inshore. And beyond the minefields, we knew that we must expect a large number of underwater obstructions, which must be cleared before the landing craft could have any chance of reaching the beaches. Specially trained volunteers, dressed in tight-fitting rubber sea-green suits and helmets, and looking rather like gnomes, leapt into the shallows to place charges and to blow up those obstructions. Believe me, they worked wonders. Meanwhile, the assault craft were creeping in. While over their heads, cruisers and destroyers and army guns on their way in put up a terrific barrage, while the Hun did his best to have it back. But in spite of the obstructions, the heavy surf and the minefields on the beaches, all the beaches in our sector were soon gained. And then started that mad rush to get the follow-up supplies ashore at greater speed than the enemy could muster his forces to his counterattack. When I left this afternoon, that mad rush against time and weather was at its height. As I came back across the 100-odd miles of English Channel to these shores, I shall never forget what I saw. There was no need for any navigation. It was just as easy as walking down Fifth Avenue. The whole way across the Channel, there were continuous lines of craft approaching the Bay of the Seine. And not only continuous lines, but rows and rows of lines stretching out on either side as far as the eye could see. Our navies at this moment are undertaking the greatest task in their histories. May God allow those men fair weather to help them in this great adventure.
That was Commander Anthony Kimmon speaking from London. We return you now to the United States.
You've been listening to Commander Anthony Kimmons of the Royal Navy, one of Britain's smartest naval men. He's been through two wars, took part in the Allied landings in Africa, Sicily, and Salerno, and returned to England recently after taking part in the Allied invasion of the Marshall Islands in the Pacific. He had a front seat there as a British observer. And now for another special broadcast, we take you to NBC in Washington.
This is the NBC newsroom in Washington. Just arrived in our studios is the ambassador to the United States from the Netherlands. As a representative of a country along the invasion coast, he brings a brief message to the people of America. Dr. Alexander Loudon, ambassador from the Netherlands.
We live through sacred moments. My personal reaction to the stirring news of the Allied landings on the European continent can best be expressed by referring to a beloved, but very sick relative, who in the early mornings has been put on the operation table, while the world's most skilled surgeons are doing their utmost to save his life. Naturally, all relatives and friends are impatiently telephoning to the hospital to hear the latest news about the patient's health, and the answer is, operation successfully performed and condition as satisfactory as can be expected under the circumstances. In other words, matters are in the hands of the military. Let them speak and strengthen us. Let no impatience on our part upset the patient's struggle to win. We must have faith in the military, aided by the fighting patriots. For the courage and devotion of all of them, we cannot but feel the deepest gratitude, love, and admiration. Our prayers follow them.
From the NBC newsroom in Washington, you have heard a few personal reactions to the invasion by Dr. Alexander Loudon, ambassador to the United States from the Netherlands. We return you now to the newsroom in New York.
Back once again in the NBC newsroom in New York. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we take pleasure in presenting that noted NBC commentator, Cesar Searchinger, who is also the analyst for the American Historical Association. Mr. Searchinger.
Good afternoon. First of all, let me tell you that General Eisenhower's headquarters in London will issue its second communique of the invasion at approximately 5:30 this afternoon, Eastern War Time. This will be the first communication concerning the progress of the invasion. There has only been one before, and that was the bare announcement that the invasion had taken place. So, at 5:30 this afternoon, General Eisenhower will issue the first real communique on the progress of the invasion. The Vichy radio said tonight that it must be admitted that the Allied back beachhead area has been considerably widened and that Allied reinforcements are pouring in. Yes, it looks as though the invasion were a success, as far as we've gone. It's now from 14 to 16 hours since the first Allied troops landed on the coast of France. It is definitely established by now that the main landings were made in the Seine estuary, not far from the port of Havre, that is to say, across the wide estuary of the port of Havre. The landings were made, however, on the south shore, where the fashionable bathing beaches are, such as Honfleur, Deauville, and Trouville. This 60-mile stretch of Normandy coast between the two rivers, the Seine and the Orne, is mostly flat and hasn't the steep cliffs of the coast north of Havre. Thus far, it looks as though we left Havre to one side, though it must be one of our objectives, being the second largest port of France and the nearest to Paris. It was Napoleon I, I think, who said that Paris, Rouen, and Havre were really one city with the Seine as the main highway in between. Speaking of Rouen, it is stated that our parachute troops are fighting inside the historic city, that city where Joan of Arc was burned at the stake. Prime Minister Churchill, in his second speech in Parliament today, said that our troops, ground troops this time, are fighting in the streets of Caen. C-A-E-N, Caen, 9.5 miles from the shore. Caen is an ancient city near the little river Orne, which flows into the sea about 20 miles south of Havre, across the estuary. This seems to indicate that at present we are heading southward, away from Havre. Caen is extremely important as a road junction. One of the main roads going out of it cuts straight across the Cotentin Peninsula, the peninsula that juts out from Normandy towards England, pointing straight at the Isle of Wight. Near the end of that peninsula lies Cherbourg, another great port which would be a valuable bridgehead for us. If our troops were to cut off this peninsula from the rest of Nazi-held France, we would have a large and highly protected area, roughly a triangle 60 miles wide at its base and 60 miles from base to apex, sticking out into the sea. There are also reports from enemy sources that we have landed on the Contentin or Cherbourg Peninsula direct. It seems logical, if the peninsula is our objective, that we should land at both ends at once, though the coast near Cherbourg is much more difficult because of the sharply rising hills. It's certain, however, that we have landed paratroopers on the Channel Islands of Jersey and Guernsey, which lie between 20 and 30 miles off the west coast of the peninsula. These islands, as you know, are British territory, having been in English hands since the days of King John. This is the only British territory the Germans held in this war, and thus the first liberation of British territory has taken place. All this, the fighting in Caen and the landing of paratroops on the Channel Islands, does point in the direction of our aiming to use the Cherbourg Peninsula as a base of operations, possibly against Paris itself. Caen is a vitally important place both because it is on the railroad from Cherbourg to Paris and because it is the main communication point between Western Normandy and the Seine, between Cherbourg and Havre. By the way, the city of Caen, where our soldiers are now fighting, has about 50,000 inhabitants and is a commercial town of some importance. It has close associations with English history, for it is where William the Conqueror came from and was originally buried. The castle, which is still used as a barracks, was built by the Conqueror, and so were the famous Abbey Church, dating back from 1070, and other churches in the town. Later, Caen became the capital of Lower Normandy. It was besieged and taken by King Edward III of England during the previous English invasion of France in 1346, but it was lost again 4 years later. The University of Caen, curiously enough, was founded in the 15th century by Henry VI of England, who, I believe, also founded Eton College. Caen became one of the Huguenot towns at the time of the religious wars, and its medieval prosperity was shattered by the revocation of the Edict of Nantes under Richelieu. And now a word about Havre. Havre is the second seaport of France at the mouth of the Seine. It's 143 miles to Paris and 56 miles to Rouen. The name was originally Havre de Grasse, after the chapel of Our Lady of Grace, which stood there when Havre was still a fighting village, which was until 1516. The defenses of Le Havre are very strong. They were built by Richelieu and completed by Vauban, the greatest of all French engineers. It was bombarded by the English 5 times in the 17th and 18th centuries, but no landings were ever made. Napoleon raised Havre to a port of the first rank, and Napoleon III completed the works begun by Louis XVI. In the First World War, British and American troops used the harbor. We used it as a base for landing troops and supplies. It is obvious that we shall need it again for the same purpose. Well, the marvelous thing about this invasion is that we really seem to have achieved surprise, that most valuable thing in all warfare, especially in overseas invasion. Admiral Ramsey of the U.S. Navy says he wouldn't have thought it possible, and he himself was surprised to see no more opposition against our armada. And this, mind you, despite the fact that the operation had to be postponed for a day on account of weather conditions. Of course, against the 4,000 ships and smaller vessels we employed, the Germans had little in the way of ships, a few destroyers and submarines. And submarines aren't much good in the channel because they can't submerge deeply. So, some things were in our favor, and so far, as I said, it's been a success.
You have been listening to the noted NBC commentator, Caesar Searchinger, who is also the analyst for the American Historical Association. This is the National Broadcasting Company.